Overtime. Please,
United States Court of International Trade is now in session. The Honorable Richard K. Eaton presiding before court number 25-00066. Voss Selections, Inc. et al. Versus the United States et al. Will the attorneys please state their names for the record, starting with the plaintiff?
Colleen Sinsdack for the VOS plaintiffs.
Claudia Burke for the government.
Justin Miller for the government.
Okay. Welcome all. Following the Supreme Court's ruling in Leaning Resources, I issued an order directing the liquidation or reliquidation of entries upon which IEPA duties had been assessed. This liquidation was to be without regard to those duties. In other words, I ordered the refund of the unlawfully collected IEPA duties. Following my order, U.S. Customs and Border Patrol proposed and then implemented the CAPE program that provided a mechanism for IEPA refunds. The CAPE program has been a remarkable success. By today, over $100 billion, 60% of the $166 billion of unlawfully collected duties has been refunded. The system has processed a total of $125 billion of entries, or 75% of the $166 billion collected. But the progress on the refund process through CAPE will one day come to an end. Some importers have not and will not take advantage of the system. It is believed that these are small importers who, because of the cost or the effort involved in filing a CAPE declaration, will never take advantage of CAPE. In addition, CAPE itself does not accept certain kinds of entries, including finally liquidated entries for processing. Should further action not be taken, we are left with the prospect of the Treasury retaining billions of dollars of unlawfully collected duties and tens of thousands of importers being denied refunds they are owed. The government has appealed of that portion of my order that would provide for full refunds, and we await the Court of Appeals decision. There may, however, be other avenues that will provide for more refunds, and that is why we are here today. The plaintiffs are seeking the certification of a class action that would provide access to the CAPE system for importers with entries that have not been accepted into the CAPE system up until this time, including finally liquidated entries. The government opposes the certification of this class. For my part, I look forward to today's argument, not least because of the able counsel that will present the case, including Ms. Sinsdack. Will you?
I always appreciate that.
Will you come to the lectern, which I think is necessary for us to get the recording to work?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. All right, Ms. Sinsdack, what is the class you propose and why do you propose it?
So we have proposed a class, as we've consistently said, in an abundance of caution. We have already submitted a briefing in this before this court, arguing that the court's current order is sufficient to require the government to reliquidate and refund all of the IEPA tariffs. But the government has taken the position and is currently appealing that order on the grounds of the Supreme Court's recent decision in PASA, which precluded nationwide injunctions, at least for federal district courts. And there's a dispute about the extent to which CASA might prevent the broad injunctive relief that this court issued earlier in March. So what we did is take an instruction that the Supreme Court included in CASA, which was to say that where their determination and the unavailability of nationwide injunctive relief might prevent an appropriate global remedy in situations where that's called for, that the class certification remedy remains available. And so in the case in which the Supreme Court held that, CASA, which was a birthright citizenship case, on remand, the plaintiffs there moved to certify an injunctive class under Rule 23B2. They successfully moved to certify that injunctive class. And I think the decision there is very helpful if Your Honor is kind of looking for a basic overview of all of the considerations there. That is the Barbara versus Trump decision at 790 F sup 3D 80. So that decision actually goes through all of the considerations where someone has said you can't have an injunction under CASA, but the plaintiffs seek relief under Rule 23B2 instead. There the certification was granted, and of course it went up to the Supreme Court, and the plaintiffs prevailed. So we are sort of hoping we don't have to go up to the Supreme Court, but we're looking for a similar outcome here. And what we have said is simply we would like to certify a class of all of the importers who paid tariffs, paid the IEEPA tariffs that have now been declared unlawful, but that currently lack access to the administrative process that the government has established for obtaining refunds under refunds on the IEEPA tariffs.
So why did you seek to certify a class that would, where the remedy would only be access to CAPE rather than directing reliquidation itself?
We, to be honest, and this court has
no reason why you shouldn't be honest.
You know, it's not to be in all instances. We thought that we wanted to address the specific issue here, which was the denial of access to CAPE, because as we understand it, at least, the government has said that it will pay refunds to everyone so long as, you know, through the CAPE system. And they've just consistently said that they can't grant those refunds through CAPE. This court, of course, has the power to reformulate the class definition, and we would be and to formulate what it views as the appropriate injunctive relief. And we would, to be honest, be perfectly happy with an injunctive order that says that the government is required to reliquidate all of the entries that on which there were IEEPA tariffs paid. And we agree with you that that would satisfy, we as we understand it, it would accomplish the same end, because the government has consistently said that the CAPE system can be accessed, and it's just this reliquidation problem. And I sort of like what I take to be Your Honor's suggestion, because I think that, again, my understanding of the government's position is that the only reason that they believe they cannot just refund to all importers who paid IEEPA tariffs, and their only objection to doing so is the lack of a court order requiring reliquidation. And I think what Your Honor is referencing would supply that court order for all plaintiffs in this class action. I think that would resolve the last kind of impediment to relief, particularly because the government repeatedly stipulated that it would reliquidate tariffs in response to a court order for plaintiffs. And so I think all of those requirements would be met.
Okay. So why should any class be certified here?
Well, in our perfect world, we would not be here. I think if you look back at the relief we requested back in February, what we assumed would happen is that this court would order the government, as we requested, to put in place the administrative orders necessary to issue refunds, and that once the government had established that administrative process, refunds would flow for everyone. because again, the Supreme Court had held that those IEEPA tariffs were unlawfully collected, and the government has never suggested that it has a right to keep money it unlawfully collected. So that's what we thought should happen. The reason that we've asked for class certification is that it hasn't happened. The government has said, yes, we'll do that for most people, but if there has been this, if the tariff entry has liquidated and it's more than 80 days past liquidation, we will not actually grant the refund without a court order. Now, we think that what is required to resolve that kind of block is a court order saying, reliquidate these funds. And therefore, this is a situation that kind of calls out for class action relief, because rather than having thousands of people file thousands and thousands of different cases, which by the way, cost approximately $400 for each business to pay, which is a pretty big deal for a small business. And that's not including attorney's fees. Rather than doing that, the court can certify a class and issue a single class-wide injunction that just says you need to reliquidate the IEEPA the entries with IEEPA tariffs across the board. And we are not aware of any law that prevents a reliquidation order from being on a class-wide basis. And it would certainly accomplish all of the fundamental goals of class actions, which is judicial efficiency and fairness. Because again, rather than having courts and litigants be burdened with loads and loads and loads of different suits and this whole detailed process with envelopes floating back and forth and everything to that, you just have a single order that says for all plaintiffs in this class, the entries with IEEPA tariffs must be reliquidated. And then all of those plaintiffs have access, you know, to phase three or however you want to formulate it. So we think it's a very simple solution. And we think that it is absolutely consistent with Rule 23B2. In fact, we think that's kind of why Rule 23B2 exists. You know, if I had to write this down because I don't have the kind of brain that memorizes the text of Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. But Rule 23B2 applies where the defendant has refused to act on grounds that apply generally to the class. So refused to reliquidate the IEEPA tariff entries on for finally liquidated entries with IEEPA tariffs attached.
Okay, so you're going to have another chance to talk about this, but maybe we could talk about a couple of the government's objections to the certification of the class, at least one of which I don't fully understand, and that is the timeliness argument. And if I understand the timeliness argument, the extent that I do understand it, it seems to me it's a fairness argument. And why is it fair for this class to be certified now after the Supreme Court has made its decision?
So I think the reason that it is fair is because there's no potential for gamesmanship based on class certification, given that this court is going to decide all of the refund issues. So I think if you look at the Supreme Court decision where these kind of fairness fairness concerns come from American Pipe, and then you look at subsequent Court of Appeals cases considering this, the fear is that someone is going to, you know, try their hand at a case, and if they win, they'll certify a class, and you know, everybody gets to benefit. And if they lose, they won't do anything, and then everyone can try to litigate the issue in different forums where they might get different results. But here, that's not a possibility. This court is the only court that is hearing these cases. Congress actually provided that this court has exclusive jurisdiction. So the kind of concerns that I think, honestly, usually are very real in class action cases regarding timing about gamesmanship simply don't apply. And of course, the text of Rule 23 actually simply says as early as practicable. And here we have certified a class as early as practicable because we moved to certify at the point that it became clear that the government was not going to be willing to grant the relief that we believe is the natural, should be the natural result of the merits victory.
In your papers, you say that the government points to no issue it would have litigated differently, no evidence it lost, or settlement choice it made in reliance on the absence of a class. Does that, in addition to prejudice, does that also cut toward the evidence? Any bearing on the timeliness issue?
Yes. I mean, again, the timeliness inquiry it does just come from the text of Rule 23. So what we're applying is the words as early as practicable. And I think courts have kind of baked into that as sort of, is this fair to the defendants? And all of the considerations that you just articulated show why it is. And I would also note, you know, the government hasn't pointed to anything that they would have done differently. But even if they tried to now, that would just be implausible because this court has exclusive jurisdiction. So, I mean, it's hard to imagine what the government, you know, would have done differently other than be happy that they don't have to spend the resources litigating each individual case where we all know what the result is. And it's just, does a plaintiff have to file to have to spend $400 in attorney's fees to get that result?
Mm-hmm. And how about the objection that the result of all of this is going to be, in most cases, a refund, and refund is money, and that means that the provision of money is not merely incidental to the relief being granted. Why? Does the word incidental mean something other than what one might initially think it meant?
I don't think so. Insofar as yes, as an incident of the injunctive relief that we are seeking, many plaintiffs will have access to refunds. In fact, all of those who paid unlawful tariffs under IEEPA will have access to refunds. But that is an incident of the relief. It is not the relief itself. And I think it's important to kind of look at Walmart, where a lot of these sort of issues first came up. And Walmart was just a very, very different case, because what was clear in there was that in Walmart, the plaintiffs wanted the judge to issue orders that would put money directly into their pockets. And they had sort of tried to frame it in this way that they were also seeking injunctive relief, and so B2 could be involved. But what they were looking for, the final relief they were looking for from the judge, was pay these plaintiffs this amount of money. And that created all sorts of problems. For one thing, damages calculations in class actions are a huge mess. The Supreme Court is actually, you know, they tried to consider standing to deal with some of these damages issues, and then they couldn't. They had to dismiss that case. But the calculation of damages is a problem. It often means that common questions don't predominate because there's so much that has to be done to figure out how much and all these sorts of things. We are not asking for any of that. And frankly, that's partially because the government has set up this great administrative system and demonstrated that they are very capable of quickly assessing and determining exactly how much each refund, each person is entitled to a refund and sending that along. And it's just a whole separate administrative process. And we aren't asking the court to, you know, get involved in damages calculations or anything like that. In fact, what we are is doing exactly what the plaintiffs were doing in Johnson, which is the Seventh Circuit case where Judge Posner went through and explained in, I think, very clear detail why this kind of request for an injunction that might have might give incidental access to money is still very much in the heartland of Rule 23B2.
Okay, so Judge Posner says that I reform this contract that's been in place for years.
Correct.
I reform the contract, but people are going to get money as a result of this. We know that. But what you do is you put the reform contract next to the claim of each individual. And if the provision of the money is essentially mechanical, that the provision of the money is incidental. And here we know that the customs has mechanically processed 25 million entries already. And so at least that's an argument that the provision of the money is incidental.
Your Honor said that beautifully. I will just read from what is, I think, my favorite line in the Johnson decision, where Judge Posner is determining when, like, an ultimate Rule 23B2 relief would be appropriate. And he says, should it appear that the calculation of monetary relief will be mechanical, formulaic, a task not for a trier of fact, but for a computer program, so that there is no need for notice and the concerns expressed in Walmart, Rule 23B2 applies. And here, I mean, we have the CAPE system, which I think is a wonderfully, you know, established so far computer system that can do all of this. And so truly the monetary relief is incidental.
Is there anything else I should know?
I think those are the big things for now. And of course, I'm happy to respond to further questions.
Okay, and you'll have another chance.
Great, thank you.
Okay, Ms. Burke, why is this all wrong, the certification?
I love that question. So I want to start out a little bit with a bigger picture. What was missing from Voss's explanation or argument is the whole reason why 23B2 and the whole scheme and the whole timing of it came to pass. So, of course, it used to be, and the entire system is based on individual cases. And at some point,
forgive me, when you say the entire system,
the entire legal system is based on individuals bringing individual cases. And at some point, rules were changed to allow lots of parties to group together. And there was a class action provision, but with no timeliness requirement for certification. And parties were jumping in at the very last minute seeking a class. And that's when Rule 23 was amended. And it was amended to require that the certification decision be made as early as practicable in the proceedings. Now, and the idea is that.
Yeah, that's what I was, yeah. I'm going to try to get to the idea.
Yeah, the idea.
I don't understand the idea of timeliness perfectly. It's not prejudice. It's something else. And what is it?
So the idea is that both sides run the risk of an adverse class-wide decision. So if the class prevails, the whole class gets the advantage. If the class doesn't prevail, the defendant, having run the risk of a class-wide loss, is entitled to take advantage of its victory by foreclosing any litigation by a class member. So the defendant is supposed to get the advantage of the original system, where individual cases are brought and the defendant gets to litigate the question, knowing what the risks are. So I want to go through some of the gamesmanship arguments that Voss makes, and I'm not accusing anybody of gamesmanship here, but I'm just going to go through the things that they have said and the things that have happened in this proceeding from the very beginning that might have affected the party's strategic decisions along the way. So the suit was filed in April 2025. The CIT's decision came out on May 28th, the Federal Circuit's on August 29th, and the Supreme Court of in February of 2026. And it filed its motion here June 6th, I think. Along the way, CASA was issued in 2025. So it should have put everybody on notice that the government was in no way conceding that it would have to pay refunds on a like a so-called class-wide basis. There was no way conceding that there would be universal relief. So it's confusing to me to hear that, because I think everybody should know what the government's position is on this point, and they should have known as of 2025 when the Supreme Court issued its decision in CASA. Then the Federal Circuit told the court in the Voss proceeding that it was bound by CASA. Then,
well, this is really, forgive me, I don't have the language in front of me, but does it say bound any place, or does it, is it more of a, why don't you take a look at this, because the Supreme Court has already said this?
Yeah, I mean, you and I have had this discussion in the last conversation where I was here, and I don't want to belabor that point. But in our view, the Federal Circuit ordered this court to apply the holding in CASA.
Okay.
So then in the Supreme Court argument, Voss's counsel.
It didn't say how to apply it.
No, it did not.
In a way, I applied it. But there you go.
Yes. And I'm not going to say anything more on that. Yep. So after the Federal Circuit decision, Voss's counsel at the Supreme Court was talking about the remedy issues. And Voss's counsel itself said the court could issue prospective relief, as if that were a potential option. Then Voss asked for a permanent injunction and explicitly declined to request a universal injunction. Now, Voss says that the reason it did that is because it assumed that the government was just going to refund all the money. I have no idea why anyone would assume that based on the CASA decision and just based upon the government's position in these cases for a very, very long time. So I think that hopefully gives a little bit of perspective to the question of timeliness. All of the cases that the parties are citing here are cases where the class certification issue comes up at some point at the trial court, well before the appellate decision, well before the Supreme Court ruled. I mean, none of the cases have this kind of a timeline where you wait until the very, very end, until final judgment, and then request a class. But
here there wasn't a trial.
Oh, there was a summary judgment.
And
which was a decision on the merits.
Uh-huh. And what arrived at the Supreme Court was a question of law. Why was it? I still don't understand why, as a matter of fact, it's unfair in this case to certify the class after the Supreme Court has ruled.
The court isn't convinced by all of the procedural strategic decisions that were made by plaintiff's counsel along the way and what those strategic decisions might have signaled to the government. If the court isn't convinced that those strategic decisions, if they had been made differently, would have also made us respond differently. And I can't say how. It's not a burden to say how. The plaintiff says that we haven't articulated any prejudice. It's their burden to demonstrate that an injunctive
class. If I understand the timeliness argument, it's not prejudice. It's something different. It's
risk allocation.
I'm not exactly sure what it is.
So it's risk allocation.
So you don't. I don't believe that the government could ever have possibly thought that this case would only involve the plaintiffs that were before the Supreme Court. I just can't believe that. You don't have to actually answer this, but I don't believe that any defendant in the government's position could possibly have thought that eventually someone would try to make the decision of the Supreme Court have general applicability.
I'm not saying that we didn't consider that a party might make the argument, but I don't think it's reasonable to assume that the government would have believed that that would be the right outcome. And I would
not the right outcome possibly, but okay. Keep going.
Well, the other thing I'd point to is this court's decision in the Section 122 cases, where the court did the exact opposite from what it did in Voss in the AIPA cases, where it limited the relief just to the parties before the court, based on the same arguments that that we've been making. Just want to make sure. Okay, so I'll talk a little bit more about Voss saying that it didn't know that a class would be needed until the very end. And in addition to CASA being a relevant factor, there's a couple of other things that I think would have likely tipped Voss off. We were very, very careful starting with the Voss case itself, where we were very clear to say that the government would refund to plaintiff any duties or any tariffs that were owed with interest. And we never said anything in this court to suggest that we were going beyond the plaintiffs. A class certification in this court, as far as we understand, has only happened once, certainly not the way that the HMT situation shook out, and, you know, for better or worse, but it's not something that this court has routinely done. So I don't think there would be any.
Don't I know it?
With any reason why the parties would expect that the court would do it here. And starting in November of last year, when parties started asking for injunctions in these cases, we couldn't have been more clear about what our intentions were. And our intentions were that we had no intent, we were not going to challenge this court's ability or jurisdiction to order refunds in cases brought before the court. And we said it, I don't know how many times. And so the idea that any plaintiff as sophisticated as these plaintiffs would have not understood where we were coming from is astonishing. Getting to why, well, I don't know if Your Honor still wants to talk about those issues, but
I only want to hear what you want to say.
Okay. So getting to why this isn't a proper injunctive class, you know, even if they had done it timely. And to me, the boss's argument is totally circular. There is no legal question before the court. The question is, are there parties who can benefit from an injunction from the court, or are there not parties that can benefit from an injunction? So they've created this class and they've created this injunction, but the injunction is just to let the parties get relief, which is exactly what a 12B3 class is for, not a 12B2 class. There's no question of law or fact that anybody has to answer. All someone has to do is file a complaint and they get relief. And, you know, it's possible that had there been a class earlier, I don't know what would have happened, but really this is just a 12B3 class disguised as an injunction. And as for whether it should be a 12B3 class, it's not something that Voss has asked for. So I don't intend to get too much into it, but I will say that the idea of there being this being incidental relief is also astonishing to me. The counsel in this room have participated in, I don't know, maybe over a dozen conferences with this court where the parties and the court have gone into great detail about this system and how it's going to work and problems that people have with it and complaints and changes. This is not incidental. This is not a situation where somebody, there's an injunction, everybody gets to use the system, and then the case is over. I mean, at best, maybe there would be like a subclass, which is what happened in the Johnson case, subclasses for the monetary relief. But the idea that CAPE relief is incidental just is contrary to the last several months of everybody's lives here. And I think that's most of what I had to say. I will say, with respect to the burden on plaintiffs, which we do understand, there is a filing fee. And I hope it's not out of line for me to suggest that the court could waive its filing fee for these cases.
Well, for holy.
The court could even provide a template complaint. I don't know. I mean, if the court is concerned about it, but these are all things that could make plaintiffs' lives easier. And the other thing I'll say, it's the last thing I'll say, is, as you said, the progress that Customs has made is really remarkable. After CAPE phase three is mostly over and we see how it shakes out, I personally would like to see what's remaining. And I know the court wants to see what's remaining, but I'd like to wait to see what's remaining before we try to figure out how to solve all those problems, because it could be more, I'm hoping it's more limited than everybody fears. I don't know, but that's my hope. And it just seems like would be the more efficient way to handle it.
Okay. Two things. First of all, even though I'm stunned by the prospect of waiving the filing fee, I'm grateful to you for suggesting something else that could happen here, because something else may have to happen one day. Thank you.
Thank you.
And by the way, if anything occurs to you after Ms. Sinstack has made her argument, I'll give you another chance, and then I'll give Ms. Sinstack another chance.
Thank you, Your Honor. I guess I this is not one of those, like, when a lawyer stands up and says, I am genuinely confused, but they're really not. They know exactly what's going on. Mm-hmm. The government has said that it knows it needs to refund all of the IEPA money and that it intends to. I think that happened. You know, there was a lovely government witness here explaining that. And not just for plaintiffs. I mean, as Your Honor began this case by this hearing by saying, there, you know, I think there's like 90% of IEPA refunds are being processed through CAPE, and the vast majority of those people are not plaintiffs. So the assertion that we should have assumed that relief would be confined to plaintiffs is belied by the government's own very, very commendable conduct here, but commendable and also, of course, legally required. I mean, the reason the government needs to refund, I mean, hopefully it's partially the goodness of their heart, but it's also because they have no legal entitlement to keep the money. And it would be a tremendous waste of government resources to individually fight all of those cases. The reason we're sort of here is because they have decided that they really want to individually fight this small selection of cases. And they haven't explained why it is better for the government to deal with each of these cases individually. And I think that those of us who have been in settlement conferences know how much work, you know, that requires. But they say that plaintiffs should have moved earlier, but they don't explain why that there's actual prejudice, because in fact it would seem like it would relieve them of a whole number of burdens. And I think
that you've mentioned, if I'll say this again, is if I understand this timeliness argument correctly, it is not, it doesn't cut toward prejudice so much as fairness And and I'm having difficulty completing the sentence. It would be unfair to the government to certify this class because I have difficulty getting beyond because.
So I do too, and I'm going to say what I think is the because, and I work for the government. I love the government. Please, I am not in any way trying to be.
You love the government.
The United States government as an entity, an institution, let me say that. I think the reality is that the government doesn't want this because they're hoping that filing a action is going to be a disincentive to a number of people who will never pay the money, or even with the waived fees, will never hire the lawyer to submit the complaint. And I understand that. And I think the government has actually said before here, maybe that they're concerned that if there's a class-wide relief available here, then the next time the government is found to have unlawfully withheld a large amount of money in the form of tariffs, there might be a class-wide remedy that requires them to issue all of that money, and therefore there's going to be wider relief. I do think that's what's going on, because I just haven't been able to figure out any other reason that the government would want to individually litigate thousands of cases. And then going so far as to suggest you can waive the filing fees, which I think is going to have like a lot of costs on this, you know, the court, I'm sure you know your own finances, but it feels like this whole elaborate process that we have in this effort to not do this, not just use the class solution that seems to be right there and created for this very purpose. It's kind of impossible to understand. And I'd also note, you know, I really think this timeliness thing is a little bit of a red herring, because as I understand it, and frankly, we're prepared to do this, if we have some plaintiffs with importers who are currently unable to access CAPE because their refunds are 80 days past liquidation, we can file a class action right now on behalf of them and all similarly situated persons. And then this entire timeliness argument just falls out. And I mean, that is what we're doing. We have a plaintiff who is in exactly that situation. And so class certification seems obvious, but it's like the game here does not seem to be worth the candle. And I think the government is really trying to turn that around and say, like, nobody has ever done anything like this before. How can you do this? Really, this is like a very weird, weird, weird situation. The government has set up an administrative system that through which it is voluntarily, or perhaps under an order, I'm not sure what position they're taking on that, but paying out over $100 billion in refunds, and they just won't let this little group of people, or not so little, I think it's about like $14 billion worth of claims, so they just won't let access that without these individual actions. And I think that the struggles your honor is having are just because that doesn't make any sense. And Rule 23b2 on its face is just a perfect solution here. And seems like we should just go with it. Now, the other thing I wanted to answer was, I think that the government suggested there was no common legal issue here, but there is. The government has said that it is currently lacks the authority to reliquidate entries that are more than 80 days past liquidation. And so what the simple legal question is that the court needs to answer is, you actually must, you are required to reliquidate those entries. And so this injunction can require them to reliquidate all of these entries. If there is really no actual dispute, and I think I heard the government say that all that people need to do is file a complaint, well, then these are like advisory opinions or something, because like you can't have an action where nobody is disputing anything. So I'm not really sure where that argument goes, but I don't think it works. And so like the last thing that I would like to say is, you know, I really do think if you look at the Supreme Court's decision in American Pipe, where again, the kind of timing concerns get discussed, and this is from around pages 549 or so, it's important to note the court is dealing with Rule 23B3 actions. So a lot of the concerns there are about damages actions. Second, I agree with you that they are concerned about fairness, and they don't want litigants to be doing unfair things that sort of, you know, contribute to the inefficiency of the judicial system. I don't think it's us that's trying to do that right now. I think right now we have, it's defendants that are trying to say, don't grant a class action, because that would just allow the court to issue a single order for all of the people who are similarly situated, instead require everyone to file these individual claims. And I think that's the problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Burke, has anything occurred to you?
So a couple things. Mr. Miller reminded me of the court's small claims pilot. I actually don't know what's going on with that at the moment, but I know that the Rules Committee was tasked with working on it several years ago, and I worked on it. It should be or could be an option for parties here. Where the court could provide a template or something like that. It's true what Ms. Sinzak just said, that we don't really intend, I mean, for the most part, to fight cases that are brought for plaintiffs who are actually owed refunds. You know, there could be cases where there's like a one-off problem, but we don't intend to fight them. And so I can see how a more generalist practitioner, particularly one with a lot of Supreme Court practice, would think that there could be very creative solutions to this. And I mean, maybe there could be other creative solutions to this, but I think what's missing from Voss's point of view is the rules that this court and trade law operates under. And so we're all used to it. It's incredibly arcane and Byzantine, but the rule of finality means something. That's the reason why customs can't liquidate or reliquidate these entries. To say that customs could just do it because it's the more creative way to do it would upend decades of Federal Circuit precedent. And you can agree with it, you cannot agree with it, but that's the system that we live under. We also live under an entry by entry system where every classification case, every anti-dumping duty case stands on its own. And everybody's very careful to make sure that orders from the court are limited just to the entries in the particular case. I was not around during the harbor maintenance tax situation. I assume that was part of the court's concern to sort of honor the entry by entry nature of customs and tariff and duty law.
Well,
yeah, I could be wrong.
I don't think so.
Okay.
But
well, if I were around then, that would have been something that I.
It was an export.
Right. Right. So it wasn't entries. It was a payment. Yeah. Got it. but I guess what I mean is the court sort of lives in that world where there is no sweeping relief because the law, the Federal Circuit and the Supreme Court law in this area is very limited. The relief is always very limited to the entries that are at issue, and it could have been in the back of Judge Rustani's mind. I don't know,
but it seems to me that because if a class action were certified, all of the importers would become plaintiffs, and because they would all become plaintiffs in any order. even an order for reliquidation in the context of a class action would be an order that would comply with at least what I believe is your would be your reading of Shinye. So I think that a class action would provide the necessary order, not completely dissimilar to what has been happening in the 3,700 cases that we have.
Yeah, I'm not disputing that. What I'm saying is that, I mean, for all of the reasons that we discussed before, it's far too late in the process to make that decision. And I'm not saying that there aren't other creative solutions that we can come to at this point. Well, I feel like I've thrown some out today, but that's all I have. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Your Honor. You sort of took my first point, which was going to be that the government has conceded that this court can issue an order that circumvents any finality problem that the government believes might exist. And I think they just recognize that, yes, a class order requiring all the relief requiring reliquidation with respect to all plaintiffs would do it. We have not seen anything that says it needs to be an individualized order. And again, the government's repeated stipulations before the Supreme Court's decision said plaintiffs, not with individualized court orders. But even if they had, of course, the government can't invent a new requirement of individualization. So the class mechanism works. I think that the assertion that the CIT doesn't do class-wide relief is belied by the fact that the CIT's rules include the class action mechanism, which clearly establishes that that is a mechanism for relief that is available. Now, opposing counsel is correct that I do not regularly practice in this court, and I am more than willing to believe that in the vast majority of cases, there are specific features that make the class action mechanism totally inappropriate or at least inadvisable. I'm willing to spot the government that because I haven't been in those cases and because, you know, I do think this is a form of relief that isn't exercised that often here. That said, this request fits the rules. As I've said, I've called it very weird. Maybe I should call it a more legally something that sounds a little more sophisticated. This is a unique situation insofar as we have the government voluntarily opening an administrative process and voluntarily making it available to 90% of those who paid these unlawful IEEPA tariffs, and then refusing to make it available to a set of importers who did absolutely nothing wrong, did not differentiate themselves in any way. It's just about the date. And the inequity there is sort of enhanced by the fact that many of them, the date passed while they were waiting for the government to open up the IEEPA, the CAPE system for the next phase. So the government is sort of growing that group of individuals that is forced under their scheme to file individualized suits by the day. And that again just returns me to the fairness concerns. So I wanted to emphasize, I may have gotten, sometimes I get too exuberant, you'd be shocked to hear, but I don't mean to say like there's going to be class actions all the time, there should be class actions all the time, that's everything we should do. What I mean to say is that the class action requirements are satisfied in this case, and declining to certify a class is going to lead to waste, judicial inefficiency, and a huge amount of burden on small businesses that cannot afford it, on this court, and really on the government itself that is going to have to litigate these things. And in those circumstances, we think it's very appropriate to award class action relief. I'll also just put a little curlicue and note that it's very interesting. At the beginning of the HMT, the Baxter case, denying class relief, one of the things it says is there's a presumption of regularity and a presumption that the government is going to have this organized and systematic process for giving everybody refunds. So I think that Baxter was based in part on the assumption the government wouldn't sort of arbitrarily insist that a particular group of individuals would be forced to file these individualized suits. So thank you.
Thank you. Well, this has all been very illuminating, as I thought it would be. And is there anything else to come before the court? If not, court's adjourned.
All right. Court stands adjourned.